Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Mio Sakashta. She directs the Oceans Program at the Center for Biological Diversity. She's an attorney and works primarily on marine conservation. So first off, I would like to thank you for being on the program, and I would like to thank you for your work in defense of the oceans.
Well, thanks, Derek. Thanks for having me.
So can you give people sort of – and we live on a planet that's, what, two-thirds, three-quarters water? And, I mean, the oceans are obviously hugely important to the planet. I know some people call this a water planet. And can you tell the listeners a little bit about the state of the oceans?
Yes, I would be happy to. So one of the things is that we all know that our oceans are just amazingly beautiful and incredible resource that's out there. And our oceans are actually teeming with wildlife, and they have sea turtles that migrate from Japan to the Pacific coast of the United States, and we have whales that roam up and down our coasts. And at the same time, while we have all this rich biodiversity out in the oceans, I think it's safe to say that our oceans are really in trouble. There was a report in Science magazine just a few weeks ago that clearly made this statement, and the scientists were really warning that marine life is on the verge of a crisis, and so our oceans are facing an extinction crisis if we don't take steps now to address some of the threats that are out there. And you know, one of the things is that the oceans, they are probably our most vast wilderness, yet we are polluting them, and there are so many activities caused by humans that are impacting our oceans that we really need to take a step back and start treating our oceans like we care about them.
So what are some of the threats to the oceans? I know, for example, that it was 5 years ago, there was 10 times as much plastic as phytoplankton in the oceans. I know that if you weighed all the oceans and all the fish in the oceans in 1870 and then weighed them now, they would weigh the weight of all the fish would be about 10% of what it was then. Those are some effects, though. What are some of the threats?
I think you hit on some of the very key points about what the threats are in the oceans. Plastic pollution is clearly an overarching threat to wildlife in the oceans. You know, I'll quickly just run through a few of the threats, and then maybe we could go into a little more discussion about some of them. Probably some of the biggest overarching threats to our ocean ecosystems, and one of the things that's really going to potentially drive this extinction crisis, is greenhouse gas pollution. And we see a couple of very important effects from greenhouse gas pollution of ocean warming and ocean acidification. On the flip side of that, we're also exploiting our oceans to get more dirty fossil fuels out of them. So we're, you know, have a lot of offshore oil and gas production off the coast of the United States and actually around the world, and that's only contributing to those overarching problems even more. Noise in our oceans. We have ships that are constantly transversing our oceans and putting out a ton of noise. Navy sonar, military sonar from different countries that can cause animals to go deaf and can cause them to strand. And exploring for oil and gas also causes a lot of noise pollution. And you had also mentioned that, you know, we once had these abundant fisheries. You could go, you know, fishing off the Gulf of Maine, and you'd have so many cod that you didn't even know what to do with. And now cod are basically on a path to extinction, and they're just critically endangered right now. And the regulators are trying to take steps to stop them from completely going extinct, but they're at the lowest historic abundance ever. And so we can talk a little bit more in depth about some of those different threats, and if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. So which one would you like to talk about first?
Well, you started out with plastic pollution, so we could go ahead and start there. And that's something I think that's probably pretty close to a lot of our listeners, because, you know, I think we're just surrounded in plastic every day. You know, the stuff that comes, you know, across through our house, and you see when you're out to lunch, it's that we have plastic everywhere, whether it's grocery bags, food containers, coffee cup lids, the packaging that our food comes in. We encounter plastic in, you know, almost every piece of our life. And a lot of that plastic ends up in our ocean, and it never goes away. So if you take an example, you can look at the Los Angeles area alone, and they have plastic, about 10 metric tons of plastic fragments every day, about 10 metric tons of plastic fragments are carried into the Pacific Ocean every day in the Los Angeles area. And that plastic doesn't go away. And so some of the effects of what we see from the plastic that we're using in our everyday lives is that it's really taking a heavy toll on wildlife. So you have fish in the ocean that end up ingesting plastic. Sea turtles are particularly vulnerable because they'll mistake the floating plastic bags for jellyfish, and so they actually eat them on purpose, thinking that they found some food, and it can get tangled up in their digestive system, or it can block their air passage and really cause them a lot of harm. Seabirds, they've taken examples of seabirds, and they've studied some of these seabirds in the northwestern Hawaiian islands, and when they look at the pieces of stomach, the pieces of plastic that are in the stomachs of these birds, you know, up to 95% of the little baby albatross chicks will have plastic in their stomachs. And you also have problems of, you know, animals getting entangled up in plastic. So marine mammals, whether they're whales or Hawaiian monk seals, can end up getting caught in like old nets that have been left from fishing, or even just like the plastic wraps that kind of go around a big thing of newspaper. And, you know, I think a lot of us remember the things that go around a six-pack container, and those can entangle animals. So plastic is one of those things in our ocean that we're now having these huge floating garbage patches, and it's impossible to clean up. So what we really need to do is stem the tide of plastic into our oceans, while we're also, you know, trying to clean up some of the beaches and some of the areas where the plastic's starting to accumulate. One of the things that we've been working on at our organization was kind of a novel use of the Superfund law. So we petitioned EPA to identify some of the islands in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands chain, which is where it's pretty close to where the Pacific garbage patch is. So a lot of the garbage ends up washing up onto shore in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. So we asked EPA to identify those areas as a Superfund site because of the plastic endangerment to wildlife and the toxins that collect around the plastics. And so what the Superfund designation could potentially do is help contribute to cleanup and funding of the cleanup of those islands. And EPA, fortunately, really loved the idea of the petition, and they undertook an assessment and sort of took the first step of the process in possibly nominating this area for a Superfund site. And it would have been the first time that an area would be designated because of plastic pollution. But that's one step. But we also want to keep plastic from going into our oceans in the first place.
So what would happen if, reasonably best case scenario, if they were declared Superfund site, and what would that mean? Does that just mean that there is then funding for repeatedly cleaning the beaches every time plastic floats up?
It has a couple of possible consequences. So, you know, yes, one is that they would have to develop a plan on how cleanup of the plastic would occur. And yeah, since it keeps showing back up, I would imagine that it would have to be a long-term plan to address the ongoing pollution that would show up on the island. And I think one of the other potentially powerful provisions of the Superfund Act is that there can be some producer liability for cleaning that up. So, you know, I don't know the exact mechanism of how that would work, because obviously plastic is ubiquitous and has a lot of different producers. But in other pollution situations, sometimes they'll be able to, you know, designate sort of a market share approach to it or something like that. So there might also be a possibility of holding the producers of plastic accountable for some of the cleanup.
I know this is off the point, but it strikes me that, it would be really hard work to be walking along, you know, to have to be cleaning that stuff up physically. But I think your workplace conditions, you know, would be not bad. Walking along a Hawaiian beach, that'd be a good part of that job. yeah, gotta go to work. Too bad. It would be actually hard work to be, you know, picking the stuff up. But anyway, so what happens?
I think that they do take volunteers out in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands for marine debris pickup. So, you know, if you're interested, you can
maybe some listeners will do that. That's great. So let's take a piece of plastic. You know, somebody throws away a, you know, styrofoam cup, or they throw away, you know, some piece of plastic, I don't care what it is, ping pong ball. They throw it into the ocean off of Santa Barbara. And what happens? It's what happens to the plastic once it gets to the ocean? And what eventually, okay, it mechanically breaks down, right? It goes from its whatever size it is down to a smaller size. And then what happens?
That's right. So, unless, of course, an animal chokes on it right away. But, yeah, right. A lot of the plastic that's in our ocean has started to break down. Plastic does not degrade quickly, so it is actually kind of a long process. But there's a lot of motion and action in the oceans that will break plastics up. But what they do is they don't completely go away. So then you end up with these microplastics, which become, you know, very difficult to clean up. And a lot of our listeners have probably participated in some of those coastal cleanup days where you can go out and count the number of cigarette butts you clean up and coffee cup lids. But a lot of the pieces that you can't pick up are those that are really, really small, you know, smaller than your fingernail. And those are the ones that are also starting to gather up and go out into our gyres in the ocean and collect in, you know, like the Pacific garbage patch, where I think you had mentioned in part of the introduction to this section that you can have plastic particles that are suspended in the water that are, you know, that are actually more plastic. They outnumber the number of like plankton and zooplankton and things that other animals would eat or other wildlife. So they're floating out there, suspended in the ocean and being mistaken for food and you know, getting in the path of into the food chain.
So it'd be like for every 10 bites you take, 9 of them are plastic.
Yeah. Yeah. In the Pacific garbage patch, I think the number is that plastic outnumbers the zooplankton 6 to 1.
So one of my fantasies has been that and I want to be really clear, and I don't know how well you know my work, but you know, I am all for stopping this culture from killing the planet using any means necessary. And so I'm not one of those people who says, oh gosh, we can do whatever we want because nature's so resilient. I'm not one of those people at all. But having said that, one of my fantasies, every time I see some news article about how there's some sort of fungus who eats plastic, it makes me really happy. And is there any realistic short term, because obviously long term the world's going to do whatever the world does, but is in the short or medium term, is there any hope? I hate that word, but is there any realistic possibility? Once again, I'm not letting plastic producers or anything off the off the hook here. I just know, for example, that there are 450 dead zones in the ocean. We've not talked about that yet. But there's 450 dead zones in the ocean, and there's one that has disappeared. And the one that disappeared was in the Black Sea, and the reason it disappeared is because agriculture stopped in the region with the collapse of the Soviet Empire. And I just actually learned this a few weeks ago. Anyway, when the Soviet Empire collapsed, it was no longer feasible to do industrial agriculture. And with the primary insult being stopped, then the dead zone actually recovered over about 20 years. And so here's my question. If plastic production stopped, is there any chance for the ocean to get rid of it on its own?
Well, I don't think that the ocean can entirely get rid of the plastic that's out there and swirling around. But right now those garbage patches are covering a good percent of our ocean. I think it's like 40% of our ocean. But, you know, the oceans, as you mentioned, are two-thirds of the planet. And so stopping now is a step in the right direction. There would still be a lot more ocean. It's a spectrum, I guess. You know, we're not to the point where the plastic is a complete disaster for wildlife yet, but we're headed in that direction. And if we can stop now, we'll save even, you know, more habitat, and there'll be, you know, less plastic to water concentration, I guess, would be the point. And I think that is a similar, the analogy that you have there, I think, is similar to our climate crisis that we're facing. And, you know, here's something that is widespread. We have a ton of carbon dioxide pollution going into the atmosphere. We need drastic, robust steps to reduce carbon dioxide pollution, you know, to save our oceans and to save even, you know, ourselves from the harmful consequences of climate change. And but again, I think it's a spectrum, and the better steps and the quicker we can take them now, the more likely we'll be able to prevent some of the worst consequences of ocean acidification or global warming.
Well, that makes a nice segue. So let's talk about that. I think most people who are listening to this know what the, you know, greenhouse gases are leading to global warming and where they come from. But take it from there to the ocean acidification.
Yeah, so greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, you know, just as it goes into the atmosphere, is also absorbed into the ocean. And the ocean actually absorbs about 22 million tons of carbon dioxide every day. And that carbon dioxide, while it's provided a great buffer against, climate change, what it has done is it's had an impact on our oceans. So when carbon dioxide goes into the water, it's kind of like a sponge sucking up the carbon dioxide, and it changes the chemistry of the water, causing it to become more acidic. What we've seen since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, the oceans have become about 30% more acidic due to carbon dioxide emissions from our power plants and from driving cars and from land use changes. And the impact on marine life is potentially very severe. So we've already seen some of the early impacts of ocean acidification along our coasts. The West Coast is particularly vulnerable to ocean acidification. And in the Pacific Northwest, some of the oyster hatcheries up there have had massive failures because the waters have become so acidic. So, you know, where I think for about 6 years now, there's been a severe collapse in oyster production, and billions of oyster larvae have perished because the waters have become too acidic off the West Coast during their young stage. And what acidic waters do is they can both prevent an animal from, you know, growing its protective shell or skeleton, and they can also start to dissolve animals if it gets acidic enough. And, you know, in addition to the to the shellfish problems in the Pacific Northwest, we've also seen off the coast of California here, they've taken surveys of the plankton off the coast and found that offshore, up to like 50% of this one type of plankton, pteropods, have these severely dissolving shells. And they're relating that to the increasingly acidic waters here. And they've also found that corals in different areas of the world, in the Caribbean, off the Great Barrier Reef, are growing more slowly. And in some areas, like, they're, not growing as large as they would have because it's, you know, harder to grow their skeleton in these more acidic waters.
Yeah. And something that always really upsets me when I read about this. Obviously, the thing itself upsets me, but in addition, whenever I read a newspaper article about the oyster collapse or the reproductive failure, and this is true when this culture talks about any endangered species, you didn't do this, I'm not saying this about you, I'm saying this about the media in general, that they immediately jump to the commercial effects or the effects on the economy. And it makes me so angry because part of the problem is this culture's narcissism, the belief that the economy is more important than the real world. And yet when they're talking about – I mean, it scares the hell out of me that that shellfish populations are having trouble reproducing. And I don't actually care about the effects on industry. What I care about is that is incredibly terrifying for the effects – on the natural, the wildlife communities in the ocean. That really scares me.
Yes, I think that's a really important point. It's absolutely not just a problem of the shellfish industry, but this is a problem with our entire marine ecosystem, right? Because if you're dissolving the plankton that are at the base,
are you there?
Wait.
Can you back up? Because the phone crapped out for a second.
Sure.
So the last thing I heard you say was that if you're talking about plankton at the base and then...
Yeah, so I was saying that if with ocean acidification, if we're talking about plankton that are dissolving at the base of the marine food web, the repercussions are going to go up the entire food chain. So, you know, anything that preys on those plankton may have trouble finding food or will have to shift to a different area where the ocean acidity is not as troubling. And then you have, you know, an entirely different ecosystem regime going on. And, you know, right now we're just at the cusp of seeing some of these early symptoms. And there was a study done off the coast of Washington they were looking at tide pools and also measuring the acidity of the waters that were just off the coast there. And what they found was that, you know, when these times of year, it happens most severely during certain times of year when we have an upwelling off the West Coast. And so during these certain times of year, when the waters were more acidic, the animals in the tide pools would almost completely change in composition so that, you know, whereas before you would have had many more mussels and shellfish, in the years where they started to see more ocean acidification, those were being replaced by, kelp and seagrasses and things that were, you know, didn't need to build a shell. So it's an example of where we can see just in one little tide pool what might be, you know, happening more, you know, in our ocean ecosystems that are just off the coast. And it's certainly not restricted to just affecting the shellfish industry or the fishermen.
So what are some of the other effects of that you foresee for ocean acidification? And then not just ocean acidification, but also the warming of the oceans. What are some other effects that you expect to see if that continues unabated?
Right. So one of the big concerns that we've been working on here at the center is the coral reef crisis. And we've already seen, up till now, many coral reefs losing up to 50% or even in some areas, 75% of their coral coverage. And our coral reefs, you know, even though they only occupy certain portions of the ocean, they do harbor, I think, 25% of the marine biodiversity. So, you know, the fish and the plankton and all of these different environmental communities really depend on coral reefs. And there's also actually deep water corals as well, that are fish nurseries and places where fish forage, even in cold waters. So with our corals that are already under threat from increasingly severe bleaching from warming waters, now also facing the threat of ocean acidification, this is an ecosystem that's really endangered. And indeed, just, you know, this last year there were 20 corals that were placed on the endangered species list because of threats from climate change and ocean acidification.
And also, I want to just mention that corals are bases of larger communities, but they also can be, as well as serving as homes for other species, they themselves can be incredibly long-living beings. That there's a coral off of Hawaii that is more than 4,000 years old. I mean, some coral can live an incredibly long time. I just learned it this last year. That's why I had to say it. coral are just. Or here's another thing. I know. I just want to mention this because I think it's so cool. Working on the oceans, you know about RAS, right? And the cleaning stations. Do you know about them?
No.
Okay, RASS, WRASSE. It's a fish. And there's also these little shrimp called cleaner shrimp, and they live in corals.
Oh, yeah.
And they have what are called cleaning stations where fish of different species, including predator and prey, will line up outside their home and wait to have their teeth cleaned and to be cleaned all over, to get basically a whole, I guess you can't call them a manicure since they don't have hands, but – you know, they'll clean off their gills, and they'll clean off broken scales. And it's just, there are these incredibly complex and wondrous communities down there of all these different species who interact. It's just the more I learn about the real world, the more extraordinary I think it is, and the more horrific the destruction is.
Yeah, I like that story. I actually think, now that you mentioned that, I think I've read a children's story about the cleaner ship, the clean up fish. That's a nice point. I think, you had mentioned, you know, what are some of the other effects we'll see of ocean acidification? And something that's been found out more recently is also that it increases the occurrence of harmful algal blooms, or the toxicity of harmful algal blooms. So these are the same types of, like, red tides that have been linked to marine mammals that can come up to shore and are sick and dying, and even sometimes cause paralytic shellfish poisoning in people. And what they found is that under future levels of ocean acidification, these red tides will be, you know, 4 to 5 times more toxic than they currently are. And we're already starting to see a lot more occurrence of harmful algal blooms down in Southern California. And so this is something, you know, I think we could anticipate will be increasing and, you know, could potentially even affect our, you know, human communities that like to spend time in the ocean or eat shellfish.
So we've talked about, and thank you for saying that, and we've talked about plastics and ocean acidification, and we were about two-thirds of the way through our time, and there's still overfishing, and if you want to talk about dead zones. But before we go there, excuse me, something I'd like to ask is, so are you, I'm known for for how much I love the salmon. I just mentioned the whole thing with the wrasse. And are there parts of the ocean, this is not larger analysis, but more just you, are there parts of the ocean or creatures in the ocean or plants in the ocean or anything that especially speak to you and that you especially love and you just think are just the coolest things in the world? I mean, anybody you give a shout out to that you don't normally get to?
I love sea otters. I'm a surfer, and one of my favorite things to do is to go out surfing in Santa Cruz and see the sea otters playing in the kelp. I think that they're just amazing critters, and they're also endangered, and you know, part of our coastal ecosystem that really needs protection. But I it's hard to pick out just one. You know, I love all the whales. I even love the tiny little pteropod that is that at risk of motion acidification. Yeah. So it's hard to pick. There's so many cool ocean critters.
Well, okay, so I'm gonna ask you to pick anyway. So pick either sea otters or the other creatures you mentioned whose name I don't remember right now, or whales or whatever it is. And take like 1 minute and have audience members just fall in love with them. Like just say a couple, three cool little factoids. Like I know for sea otters, don't they wrap themselves in kelp sometimes? They don't float away if they go to sleep or something. I mean, just say some cool things about whichever one of these you want to choose.
All right. How about I choose sea turtles? And
okay.
First, I say sea otters that I keep changing. So our sea turtles have been around since about the time of the dinosaurs. And the sea turtles that we have off of our coast here in California, or I'm not sure where your listeners are listening in from, they can grow to be, you know, 300 pounds. These can be enormous sea turtles. And they take on these incredible journeys across the ocean, you know, crossing entire oceans, you know, I said in the beginning, from Japan to the Pacific coast of the United States. And they eat a lot of different things. They love to eat jellyfish. They're in trouble though. They get caught in fishing gear in their long journeys that they take across the oceans. They, you know, accidentally ingest plastic bags and different things like this. But sea turtles, you know, the other thing is that they nest in what they have a lot of site fidelity for a particular beach. So the same sea turtle will go back to the same beach every year, every time that it goes back to nest. Another kind of interesting tidbit about sea turtles is that whether they're male or female depends in part on the temperature. So, As climate change is changing the temperatures of our coasts and our beaches, we might start to see a lot more female sea turtles, because the temperature of the egg determines which gender it is.
And let's say you're a 300-pound sea turtle, and let's say you are let's say that humans, you don't have to worry about humans or fishing nets or anything. Who would eat a 300-pound sea turtle? Or by the time you get to 300 pounds, are you pretty much not many people are going to eat you?
Yeah, I think you're mostly at risk when you're a little sea turtle. But I think you do encounter a lot of different types of habitat threats as you grow up.
But once you get to be an adult, it's like, I was reading that lobsters, by the time they get to be huge, really the only ones who eat them are sea cod and humans, for the most part. So it's basically the same with sea turtles. So once they get to be really big, they're not like. Do any of the big whales eat them or anything? Or I have no idea. Actually, I'm just wondering.
Not that I know of.
Huh. Okay. So,
I need to go take a marine biology class. You know what? I would actually, the next big thing I'd like to talk about, because it's very, they just made a big announcement yesterday about it, which is offshore oil and gas. Can we
go there for
a little bit?
Absolutely.
And it actually fits in well, because it's sort of the flip side of, you know, the carbon dioxide that we've been talking about causing ocean acidification. So Just yesterday, the Obama administration announced its new five-year plan for oil and gas leasing. And, you know, on one hand, while we have Obama talking about, you know, how important addressing climate change is, you know, on the flip side, then he's going out and making a proposal that's going to lease these vast areas for fossil fuel exploitation off of our coasts. And so a couple of notable things about the proposal that stood out to me. I mean, really, we should be having no new leases if we're really looking at addressing our climate crisis. But not only that, but this five-year plan not only proposes a bunch of new leases, but it also proposes leasing off the Atlantic coast and off the Arctic, where in large parts, oil and gas drilling in those areas has been off limits. So it's not only leasing more area off our coasts for offshore oil and gas, but it is also taking areas that, you know, have been closed and opening them up. And, you know, I think that this is it's a big carbon problem, one, because we're pulling these fossil fuels out of the ocean, but it's also, you know, obviously poses the risk of the next Deepwater Horizon spill. And, you know, also even here in California, you know, one of the campaigns that we've been working on really heavily in this last year has been offshore fracking. So, you know, like we've had this big fracking boom in the United States, we recently discovered that they're fracking offshore wells off of Southern California. And what fracking is that they take water and a bunch of chemicals and they pump it at high pressures into a well to try to get more oil out of the well. And, you know, it's similar to fracking on land. And similar to fracking on land, it poses significant dangers because these chemicals are really toxic. It increases the risk of an oil spill and it increases water and air pollution around these areas. So, you know, as I said before, I'm a surfer, so just the thought of going out and surfing in waters that have fracking chemicals in them is pretty concerning. But then there's also, you know, all that wildlife that has to live out there all the time and is at risk from our oil and gas development off many of our coasts.
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, drilling with toxic chemicals in circumstances that make recovery from a disaster especially difficult, you know, I just don't know what could possibly go wrong. you know, one of the best lines I've ever heard came from someone right after Bhopal, which was that one of the people who had been injured said that no one should be allowed to make a toxin for which there is no antidote. And I just think that's the best line. And this is something that we all are supposed to learn as children, is you never make a mess that you can't clean up. And this applies to everything we're talking about, whether it's the global warming, the plastics. It's just, this whole thing is so completely insane. So we have probably 7 or 8 minutes. So can we do a like 3-minute version of overfishing?
Sure. Yes. What do you want to talk about on overfishing? It's certainly a problem. There's a lot of, you know, destructive fishing gear out there. They use these mile-long nets that can that drift out there at sea overnight and catch a lot of marine mammals and other animals. And then just that, you know, as our industrial fishing has gotten more efficient, we're just pulling more fish and marine life out of our oceans to a point where many fish species are kind of on the brink of extinction, like bluefin tuna or cod.
And one of the things that kills me about this is that the world's commercial fishing fleets are subsidized by governments to a greater value than the entire value of their catch through, you know, tax tax abatement or whatever. So what this means in effect is the public is actually paying these commercial fleets to destroy the oceans. You know, we'd all be better off if they just gave them the same amount of money and told them to stay at home in their underpants and watch The Price is Right. You know, it's just, this is one of the things that, and I learned this like 15 years ago, and I've, you know, it's one of those things where I've never been the same since, because it just, I can't wrap my mind around the fact, first off, that the oceans are so big and they are being vacuumed. And at the same time, it doesn't even make any economic sense. You know, I mean, none of it makes any sense on any level. And especially with what you said, can you talk a little bit more? I've not heard enough people talk about this, the modernization of the commercial fishing fleets and the use of like sonar and everything to find schools of fish, which makes it – so can you talk about how the increased efficiency of commercial fishing fleets has been incredibly harmful?
Yeah, you know, I think you covered it pretty well, actually. It's really just that, you know, as fishing has gotten more efficient and as the technology and gear is getting better and you can, you know, locate where the fish are and all hone in around them, you know, it makes it easier to deplete a fishery more rapidly. But, you know, I think in all of this discussion that we're talking about, so many of these harmful threats to our oceans and negative things, but I want to point out that there are some, you know, important positive steps that are moving forward too. You know, an example in the fisheries context is there's this just gillnet fishery off of Southern California that was catching sperm whales, and we were able to get an emergency regulation put in place that during the certain times, the certain areas where the whales are more prevalent, they can't operate that fishery. So that there are positive steps that can be taken. And another really positive step is even reaches beyond our own waters. And one provision of our marine mammal protection law says that we shouldn't be importing seafood that comes from fisheries that catch a lot of marine mammals and that, you know, have worse protection standards than our own laws. And so right now the United States is actually in a rulemaking process to start to finally use that provision of the law, but to really start to certify fisheries that should be able to import seafood and not certify or actually ban the imports that might be, you know, causing too much marine mammal bycatch. So there are some positive steps that can be taken, and I think that that's true across a lot of these different threats that we've talked about, ocean acidification and fossil fuels. I mean, they seem like big pieces to bite off. But, you know, one of the things that we talked about previously was that this is really a spectrum. So what we can do now to reduce carbon dioxide emissions, you know, and certainly one step is under the Clean Air Act. We've been trying to use the Clean Water Act to get waters that are identified as impaired that have too much ocean acidification so that we can start to come up with plans on how to reduce that pollution problem. And I think there's a lot of, you know, different positive steps that people can take. You know, reducing their plastic bag usage is obviously one that can help address the plastic pollution problem. So it's not all doom and gloom. And actually, even that Science magazine that I mentioned in the beginning that says we're on the course for many marine extinctions also does make the note that it's not too late, and we do still have a lot of biodiversity that we can take positive steps now to deal with.
So I have really two questions left, and thank you for all that. And one question is, if they made you the queen of all things ocean, so you can put in whatever policies you want, except you can't get rid of industrial civilization altogether. You can do that like in a year or something, but you can't do it for your first year. So basically, if you were once again going to be the queen of all things ocean, and you were going to deal with, for example, plastic. So once again, you know, what would you do, or what would you do with overfishing? You're going to be, you now, you can put in policies. Once again, you can't get rid of capitalism yet, and you can't get rid of industrial civilization yet, but you can do whatever you want for the oceans, and we will also guarantee that, like, the big fishing companies won't assassinate you for at least the first 6 months. So what do you do? What policies do you put in place that are going to defend the oceans from whatever threats you want to defend them from?
All right. I'll take rain as queen of the oceans. And the two overarching policies that I would put in place, one would be that I would put a strict cap on carbon dioxide pollution. So scientists tell us that we need to stay below 350 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And that would be my number one priority, is to establish that cap on carbon dioxide pollution. You know, all the industries would need to, you know, cut back their their greenhouse gas production and actually probably start sucking some of that carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And then the second piece that I would do that would complement that is that there should be no fossil fuel development on public lands. So whether that's in our national forests or in our outer continental shelf in the oceans, our public lands should not be the source of contributing to that climate crisis.
Okay, that's great. And then my last question is, so, and this is pretty much how I end most of these interviews, because what I really want to do with this whole series is to get people, you know, the big distinction I always think is not between the people who believe that militant resistance is necessary and those who don't. The big distinction is between those who get off their butts and do something and those who don't do anything. And what I really, really want for this is to activate people to do something. And so what do you want for listeners of this interview to do specifically to help the oceans? What are some things they can do?
Well, one thing, first of all, that plan that I told you that Obama just put out about offshore leasing is open for public comment right now. And so they should write the Department of Interior or Obama, or, you know, you can go on the Department of Interior website and find out exactly where to send this message to. But send that message that we shouldn't have new leases for offshore oil and gas. So that's one concrete step that hopefully the climate president would respond to. A second thing is, you know, we talked a lot about plastics. Just, you know, stop using plastics in your own life, or make a commitment to reduce the amount of plastics that you're using. You know, I think I've read some stories about this woman who worked for an aquarium that actually, you know, cut out all plastics in her life except for the liner of her cat food can. But I think that, you know, short of doing that, there's a lot of, you know, using your own grocery bag when you go to the store and just reducing the amount that you as a consumer put into that waste stream. A third thing is, you know, get out there, ride your bike, reduce your carbon dioxide emissions yourself, and also be a citizen scientist. Go out to your oceans and help observe what some of the impacts we're having on the oceans are, and enjoy them and love them, because they, I think that that's what can really motivate some change to protect our oceans.
I just one more question occurred to me, which is, what do you think that sea turtles or sea otters would do if they could take on human manifestation to protect the oceans? And if you don't have an answer to this right now, then we'll just have to do another interview some other time and answer it. But what do you think they would do?
Well, so, I mean, probably because you're talking to a lawyer here, but I think they would file a lawsuit against the government for causing all these problems in their habitat. And you know, and that's partly why I decided to become an environmental attorney, was that so I could represent cool clients like sea otters and sea turtles and hopefully bring the cases and the public policy change through those means for them on their behalf.
Well, that's a great answer. Thank you. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. Thank you for being on the program. Thank you for letting me interview you. And my guest today has been Mio Sakashta. This is Derek Jensen from Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.